6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Ugh, spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine. Discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
One Heat Minute Productions presents Guide for the Film Fanatic, the podcast where we invite a guest to pick one movie from Danny Perry's seminal 1986 film reference book and talk to us about that movie. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
Our guest today is one of my very favorite film critics and essayists, with bylines at RogerEbert.com, Letterboxd, The Playlist, Emmy Mag, Movie Phone, Nerdist, Inverse, IGN, IndieWire, Reverse Shot, and Vulture, among others. Her first book, Cinema Her Way, Visionary Female Directors in Their Own Words, is out now from Rizzoli. Please welcome back Ms. Mariah E. Gates. Hello, Mariah.
I realize this book is like too big for this.
It's such a great cover. It looks so good. That's such a badass cover.
The thing that's really fun about it is the foil, which the designer really fought for. And when she was first talking about it, I was like, I mean, I vaguely understand it because like Kyle Turner's book had foil on it. But when I saw it in person, I was like, I see why you fought for this foil, because it photographs differently. Every way you photograph it, depending on how your apartment is lit, when you turn off your lights, you can kind of still see the foil.
Badass.
Like night, which almost makes the book seem glow in the dark, even though it's not really, but it kind of is.
It's a presence. Amazing. You never forget that it's in the room with you. It's like one of those paintings where the eyes follow you around the place. Congrats on the book.
It's kind of like that. That's how light it is. Thank you. I just got back from a 3 week leg one of my book tour a couple of days ago, but I'm not actually sure what day I got back, nor am I sure what day it is anymore. I think it's Monday. I was in so many time zones that I'm like, what day is it? Who am I? And I think I have 2 weeks off, and then I'm like on the road again, Willie Nelson style. Trying to do all this. You know, we're working critics, so we also have like stuff.
You still got bills to pay. They don't pause the rent because the book is coming out.
Bills
they
to sure pay, don't. Got taxes to do that I have waited to the absolute last minute to do this
of
year.
Of course. Well, for those who haven't picked it up yet, tell us a bit about what the book is and how it's put together. Like what is the what is the approach?
So it is a book of interviews, sort of soup to nuts, about the filmographies, the filmic styles, themes that I think are in people's films, you know, my interpretations, I guess. And with 19 filmmakers, and I'm going to list them all real quick. It's Alison Anders, Gillian Armstrong, Lizzie Borden, Jane Campion, Martha Coolidge, Julie Dash, Josephine Decker, Cheryl Dunye, Betty Gordon, Marielle Heller, Miranda July, Karin Kusama, Mary Lambert, Mira Nair, Sally Potter, Gina Prince Bythewood, Isabel Sandoval, Susan Seidelman, and Kat Shea. It was supposed to be 20, and the last filmmaker was going to be Lynn Ramsey, and she agreed. And then she got inspiration, not for the movie that's coming out, but the next movie. She got inspiration, went up to the Highlands, disappeared. I got an extension, drop dead, and told that to her publicists, and they're like, "We'll see what we can do." And then she never came back down. I mean, I'm sure she came back down at some point, but not before my drop.
She's literally never come back.
Never been heard from again. No, but on one hand, I would have loved to have her conversation. On the other hand, I feel like that's a better story. So as a storyteller, that's a better story. So, and maybe I'll do another, iteration, and I'll catch her when she's not inspired.
There you go. No, that is a great group of filmmakers. I gotta say, hearing them all together like that, wow, Mike, we've talked to a lot of these women ourselves. Like We had Betty and Lizzie, and then I had previously interviewed Susan for the Fun City podcast. Isabel was a guest on A Very Good Year, as were you. So, yeah.
I know it's one thing to seen their movies, but I've heard all of them think out loud, which is a completely different sort of relationship, right? Because all of them, the way they sort of talk and think about movies, it's just, it's just sort of deep and wide and could have gone longer than we had time for.
Yeah. Betty Gordon in particular, our conversation took 2 days and over 3 hours, and a lot of editing had to happen because it was pretty much enough for a book. Cause she's so smart and she knows exactly what she wants to say about her films. We had to work together to sort of edit her chapter down a little bit, and we lost some really great stuff, but I think we kept the most essential stuff about her films. And she's a filmmaker that I'm glad she was on your podcast, because she's a filmmaker whose films, I think, even Variety, which is her most well-known film, is really not as well-known as it should be, but all of her films are interesting. The later ones just aren't, people don't know them, don't seek them out. They're almost all available.
I mean, you've been writing about female directors throughout your career as a writer, so this is not surprising that this is the topic for the first book. How did you land on this particular approach, that you wanted to do an interview-based volume and that you wanted to focus really on contemporary directors?
Yeah, so the original, proposal, there we go. The original proposal was to do profiles. And I'd actually done it many years ago. It was 2017, 2018. I had half finished, where it was two paragraph profiles. And then Filmstruck took my life, and then Netflix took my life. And then it just sort of stayed in the back burner. And then when Nikki, my agent, reached out to me and was like, she wasn't my agent yet, but she reached out to me and she's like, I like your work. Do you have an idea for a book? And I was like, yes. And so I sent her the original proposal, and she helped me rework it. As a profile concept, my original idea was to do 365 profiles.
Ooh.
So it was going to be a really hefty book, but she was like, so we whittled it down to, I think we were going to do 52. So it was one a week,
Sure.
And that was the proposal we sent around. And Rizzoli really liked it, because I said I wanted to have a book that was good primary source for scholars and actual film fans, but also would look visually cool so that random cool girls would buy it to have on their coffee table then accidentally learn a lot. And so that's kind of Rizzoli's vibe. But they really, in my resume, they really liked the interviews that I do for specifically the female filmmaker and focus interviews that I've done for years now. And they were why don't we do interviews instead? And then that way, the filmmakers are involved, and it's even more of a primary source that way. And then I was like, okay, so it's not going to be 52, because that's going to be the fall of the Roman Empire or something. So the goal was 20 to 25, and it was going to be 20, but it ended up being 19. But even at 19, we had to add a few extra pages because it was a little bit longer than they had expected. And I'm very grateful that they let me have those extra pages, because it's I think it, where it landed is probably the perfect length, the perfect sort of entryway for novices, sure, and also people who are scholars, like anywhere on the spectrum of enjoying film, I think can enjoy the book and have a lot to discover or learn more about things that they love.
Totally. Yeah. When I was a younger writer, before I had tried to do this, if I heard you say, oh, we went from, you know, profiles to interviews, I would have thought, oh, great, that would be much easier just to, you know, write questions yeah, and transcribe answers, like, as opposed to having to write a whole, you know, scholarly essay piece or whatever. Now that I've been doing this a while, I find the process of doing interviews for books, you know, when the subject is not on a press tour explicitly promoting something, to be borderline nightmarish, just the logistics of it.
It's a logistics nightmare getting on, especially, so most of these women are either still working or recently retired, right, or their job now is promoting their body of work, you know. Right. And getting on the schedule of like a working woman is in any profession quite difficult. Great example, Marielle Heller, she was the fastest to get back to me. Her assistant got back to me 25 minutes, which I think is a record for anything from a Hollywood person. 25 minutes. It was a yes. And then I was like, cool, when do you want to do it? And they were like, she just wrapped on Night Bitch, so she's in the edit right now. How about 2 weeks? So it was like that fast. And I got her in between like submitting her first edit and like having to go back and, you know, do the second cut or whatever. It was wild. I could not have imagined that it would happen that fast, because some of the other filmmakers, you know, took months or weeks or what have you. A few filmmakers got away from me because after many months of emailing, it was just like their assistants were like, I don't think this is going to happen. And I'm like, damn, okay. One of my favorite, Nancy Myers' rep said she was on vacation in August. And I was like, but my book's not due for another 3 months or 4 months at that point. And they were like, eh. And I was like, okay, how long is her vacation? Like, I hope she was on vacation that whole time, because that seems like the dream.
You know, but here's the thing. You know. Haven't seen enough Nancy Myers movies. I'll bet she was on vacation that whole time.
I think she might have been. And
yeah.
I'm kind of bummed, because I had some, I wanted to ask her some really like deeper questions about her films, because I think she's a really fascinating filmmaker who's really talked about in a, I don't want to say like a belittling way, but definitely not in as deep a way as I think her films warrant. Like, I think after she's passed away, hopefully not for another couple of decades, people will look back on her films as like a very certain kind of comedy that we don't have anymore, that's very specific to her, sort of the same way they look back at, like, I don't know, Stanley Donen or something, where they're like, it's only he could have made his films, only she could have made her films. And
right.
Yep. Oh, well.
Yep.
Maybe next time. Maybe I'll catch her on a cruise ship. Volume 2.
You'll catch her in the Hamptons is where you're going to catch her.
You know what? I was in the Hamptons, so I probably should have just tracked her down. You
just hung out at the right coffee shop.
Yeah.
Somebody's selling maps to celebrity homes out in the Hamptons. I'm certain of it. Yeah. All right, Mariah. So what film did you select from Guide for the Film Fanatic for us to discuss today?
So I chose Desperately Seeking Susan.
She's a woman of mystery.
You can tell that the movie was marketed in the midst of Madonna mania.
Yeah.
Like, very much front and center, as if she is the actual lead of the movie.
Yeah, not the supporting
friend.
Correct. Yeah.
There she is dancing at the danceteria. Okay, yeah. Let's see. Oh, there we go. 35 seconds in, the first appearance of Rosanna Arquette in the 2-minute trailer for Desperately Seeking Susan. I gotta say, Will Patton with the bleach blonde hair, I was not prepared for that.
I don't believe it.
I'm a housewife and I live in Fort Lee, New Jersey.
You never stop, do you?
There we go.
Oh, also, Rosanna Arquette is quoted on the back of my book. So it ties, it ties in nicely in multiple ways to the book.
Nice.
She was one of the early readers and supporters.
Nice.
No more dead bodies, okay?
I'll see what I can do.
I got to interview her for the Gandolfini book, and I found her delightful.
Yeah, she's really wonderful.
I would say that Madonna's boobs with some sort of thin lace over them actually features more in this trailer than Rosanna Arquette does. Not just Madonna specifically. If you're going to rely on mid-80s boobs in a small thing, I mean... You could do worse.
Like, dark lace is a really iconic.
I mean, that's iconic. Iconic. And I have a real bugaboo about overusing iconic, but that's an iconic.
No,
look.
It's
like
iconic.
All of the Madonna looks in this are pretty iconic.
The black lace is just like
on point.
Everybody wants to be Madonna in the black lace. Like,
yes.
I definitely did when I was a kid.
Well, as Mariah and her discuss in the book, Desperately Seeking Susan was director Susan Seidelman's second feature following the triumph of her indie success Smithereens, which you can hear all about on the No Wave Women episode of the Fun City Cinema podcast. That was the first American independent film to be screened in competition at the Cannes Film Festival. It got great reviews, made a nice return on its low budget, and the studios came a-calling. Ms. Seidelman liked the screwball script that Orion Pictures had acquired from first-time scribe Leora Barish. But as she told me when I interviewed her in 2018, quote, it changed once I got involved. It was set in the East Village, and the character of Susan wasn't this downtown punk kind of person. At the time, she was a little bit more like a hippie traveler. It was more like a Diane Keaton, Annie Hall-ish, that kind of character. And what I thought would be interesting, again, because I was familiar with downtown culture, was to kind of morph it into a little bit into the characters I knew and that I thought could be interesting in that role. And so the character of Susan changed a little bit, and then certainly when we cast Madonna. All right, Mike, what does Danny Perry say about Desperately Seeking Susan in Guide for the Film Fanatic?
He says, thank Christ it wasn't Diane Keaton. That's a wrap. That's, I mean, God bless her, but doesn't that really, like, just, and the Annie Hall comment is perfect. Like, you know exactly what movie she's talking
about.
It's
very different.
You know, and it, right?
Yep.
Yeah. All right, Dan.
Yep.
Danny says,
what might have been a conventional Hollywood farce about amnesia and switched identities has been given razzle-dazzle treatment by independent New York director Susan Seidelman Smithereens, first-time screenwriter Leora Barish, cinematographer Ed Lachman, who's particularly adept at capturing characters in context of their environment, and a delightful ensemble of hip young actors who seem born for their roles. Rosanna Arquette is Roberta Glass, the bored housewife of Gary, Mark Bloom, a successful but dull New Jersey hot tub salesman. For excitement, she reads the personals and becomes infatuated with a young couple, Susan, Madonna, and Jimmy, Robert Joy, who get together in New York through his regular Desperately Seeking Susan notices. Roberta curiously follows Susan and even buys her distinctive discarded jacket from a used clothes store. In search of her own identity, she fantasizes being like Susan. Played by Madonna as a character fitting the singer's own controversial image, Susan is a sexy, sweet, cocky, casually amoral, totally irresponsible, but forgivable, live one minute at a time hedonist who follows her own drumbeat. See, I think I'm excited to talk about that part because, like, she smokes one joint. She don't fuck nobody. She don't have a drink in the whole movie. Like, anyway, we're gonna come back to this.
Well, one guy does end up dead.
But argued she doesn't kill him either. By the way, I mean, she's there when it happens. I'm sorry, I'm interrupting Danny. My fault. By film's end, Roberta will have injected Susan's better qualities into her own personality. Ooh, that's good. Bopped on the head, she wakes up thinking she is Susan. Jimmy's friend, projectionist Dez Aiden Quinn, mistakes her for Susan. So does a killer who is after the priceless earrings Susan stole from a one-night stand, a mafia man whom the killer later iced. Roberta and Dez fall in love. Meanwhile, Gary enlists Susan's help to track down his missing wife, who has taken a job as a magician's assistant. Susan gets to spend time in Roberta's suburban home, literally switching places with her and reveling in the leisurely life Roberta has rejected. Plotline may be preposterous, enjoyably so, but we recognize the characters and the worlds they inhabit. The mind-draining suburbia and the crazy, festive, seductive, always crowded lower Manhattan that Seidelman knows and loves. Refreshingly, Seidelman and Barish like their characters, female and male. Except for the killer, they are nice, gentle people. We care about them, too. Most satisfying is the scene late in the film in which Roberta and Susan finally meet. Immediately, they and we understand the special female bond between them. Each knows that they're the only ones who know what it's like to be Roberta or Susan. It's a special moment between women, provided by women. Significantly, we learn about the murder of the mafia man, the one dead... I was trying to juice that a little bit. I really wasn't.
No.
Okay. Significantly, we learn about the murder of the mafia man, the one death in the film, not from watching the bloody event transpire, but from reading about it in a newspaper. Few of the male violence-prone Hollywood directors could have resisted showing the killing. It's no wonder that you leave the theater while Madonna's catchy Get Into the Groove plays, feeling good for a change. Also with Laurie Metcalf and Shirley Stoller. That's got to be his longest review in the book, or at least the longest one we've read so far.
That's
he really liked Desperately Seeking Susan a lot.
He really, truly did. Yes. I do have to ask before we delve into just a surface level question. Is Into the Groove the single best Madonna song? Because I think the case can be made. I might have come around
that she grew up in the 90s.
Maybe just from watching this movie so many times.
This is definitely a controversial yet millennial opinion. And that is that for me, the greatest Madonna album and era is Frozen and Ray of Light.
Wow.
And all of the songs on Ray of Light. I think it is so millennial. She has a music video, the Time to Say Goodbye. The music video is an homage to Humoresque starring Joan Crawford. How am I not going to love that?
Fair. Yep.
You know?
Yep.
Fair.
So, however, you know, obviously all of her 80s stuff is great too. And I talked to Mary Lambert a little bit about directing those later Madonna.
Nice.
We did not get Madonna to preview the book. It was a suggestion. I'm not sure if my agent even attempted, but it was a suggestion because she is connected to several of these directors.
It's a good suggestion.
I tried.
So tell me a little bit about your background with this one. Do you remember when you first saw this one?
It's very specific and tied to the origins of the book, really. And I've written about this a few times, but basically at the end of 2013, I watched two documentaries that really made me reconsider everything I thought about like canons in general. One's called The Punk Singer. It's about Kathleen Hanna, and the other
is a great film.
The other is The Girls in the Band, which was about female jazz musicians. And that was when I started to really rethink what I'd studied in college. Like, I didn't read very many women in my literature classes. And then I started thinking about films directed by women. And because I grew up in the 90s, I took it for granted that I'd seen all these films by women because I saw so many in the 90s. But, you know, that was a real outlier in terms of at least Hollywood filmmaking. And so in 2014, I started the original sort of women directing watching project was a Female Filmmaker Friday that I did every Friday where I wrote about women's films. And I saw Smithereens. I can't remember now how Smithereens got on my radar. No, I think I saw I can't remember now if Smithereens came first or Desperately Seeking Susan came first, but I found one of these films when I was watching a different Aidan Quinn movie and someone recommended Desperately Seeking Susan. I think that's the origin. And someone was like, well, have you seen Desperately Seeking Susan? I'm like, what's that? And I had vaguely remembered seeing it at the video store when I was a kid, but I didn't get it. Just failed as a Madonna fan. And I watched it and I was like, not only have I failed as a Madonna fan, I feel like I had been failed because then I fell down the rabbit hole of reading all about Susan's career and like all the films she made in the 80s. I watched them all within like a month. I didn't know she directed the pilot of Sex and the City. Like, I didn't know any of this. And I'm like, why have I learned about every other like man from the 80s and not Susan? Like, you know, like, bless Brian De Palma and what have you. But like, why are we not talking about Susan in the same like great auteurs of the 80s? It's bullshit.
Yes.
So discovering Susan's films and discovering her vast filmography is sort of how I did A Year with Women the next year. And then specifically when this book landed on the interview process, mm-hmm. I wanted to talk to women who had made at least 3 feature films so that I could look at women who had a robust career, whether it's towards the end of their career or they're sort of in the mm-hmm. first wave, like Marielle Heller or Isabel. Because I think it's still this sort of myth that most women only make one film. There might be a lot of women who've only made one film, but there are equally a lot of women who have really robust filmographies, and they're just not talked about the way their male peers are. And I think that's bullshit. Same with like Gillian Armstrong. She went to film school with like Peter Weir and Philip Noyce, but she's not talked about as one of the great Australian New Wave directors. And that's bullshit. So essentially, Desperately Seeking Susan was one of the films that really like turned me into this like rabid feminist film, you know, advocate. So but also awesome. Because it's just so cool, and all her films are so cool, and she reminds me so much of myself. Like, she went to fashion school before becoming a filmmaker. I went to fashion school before dropping out and then going to film school. You know, like, we have a lot of connections. I didn't grow up in like suburbia, but I definitely was like, I guess what you'd call like a femme punk. And I feel like Susan is very much a femme punk
very much.
That's the whole aesthetic of the book. That's why it's like hot pink and glittery and a little, you know, it's a little rock and roll. And I turned out, I think a lot of the women I ended up talking to ended up being like underground punks without me even realizing it. So that's a recurrent theme of what I am drawn to.
I mean, being a filmmaker in that male dominated industry is inherently punk. It's inherently punk.
Yeah.
You are by definition taking on the system.
Yeah.
Well, the other than their aesthetics that were available were sort of whatever, not as, you know, not good, not great. I mean, it just, I don't know. You know, it's just sort of like you're either Lonnie Anderson or, you know, sort of like maybe like dancing on a Camaro with like a snake. I mean, like the sort of, there weren't a lot of other options at that time. Maybe like you could be an astronaut, sort of, maybe. I just feel like the sort of,
like the two astronauts there were.
The
fem-punk
aesthetic was able to sort of be accessed, I think, by more people also, because you could sort of make it yourself. Like all that shit Madonna's wearing, you know, these are like, you know, bullshit that like got stolen from fucking like tables in Times Square, half of it, right? Or vintage stores. You got an old coat, like what are we, poor? It's like there's sort of access and sort of the boundaries around creating that aesthetic for yourself. I just think we're so much looser than.
Yeah, one of my favorite films growing up was Pretty in Pink. And I think that's because she was on from the a girl from the wrong side of the tracks who like expressed herself through her clothes, which is very much me.
Right.
In my hometown, like wearing dresses that my mom made for me that everyone made fun of, but they looked cool, and I know they looked cool. So
yeah.
Fuck my friends. They're not really your friends if they don't think you look cool when you know you look cool. Very true. So this movie, like, I found this movie. It hit me like a ton of bricks. I wish I had seen it as a kid and been obsessed with it like I was, like all the other films I obsessively watched as a kid. But I have since the, you know, I guess 11 plus years that I've this film's been in my life, I have watched it many times. I have the Blu-ray. I keep hoping that Criterion will put out like a really nice edition. Fingers crossed. We'll see. I think it deserves it. Ed Lockman's still alive. He can come and talk about it.
He could color correct it. He could sign off on it.
He can make it as beautiful as we know it is.
As we know it is.
So, I don't know. This movie, I don't know how you can see this movie, watch this movie, and not fall in love with the movie, with Madonna, with Roseanne Arquette. And with,
if you've ever loved New York, this movie feels like a hug, too. I mean, just like, oh my God. In a way that, I mean, we've...
And then, you know, Des being a projectionist, like, I worked in movie
Cinema
theaters.
Cinema Paradiso!
He's probably the hottest. I think he's the hottest projectionist. Like, he's a fake. No projectionist has ever been as hot and charismatic as Des. No. They're usually weirdos. So I love that she created sort of a fantasy of what a projectionist could maybe be like.
Yes. No, yeah. Friend of the show, Sean Burns, who is a projectionist sometimes by trade, has said that, like, Aidan Quinn is like, you know, that's your role model when you're a projector. It's still to seem half as cool when you're when you're working in a projection booth as Aidan Quinn does.
The woman who did the illustrations of my book, Alex Kittle, is a projectionist at the Brattle. Nice. So shout out to the Brattle. And she's the only other projectionist I think that is as cool and charming as no offense to Sean, but as Des in this movie.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. I was, you know, I told Mike when we were sort of hashing out, you know, we do each show and then afterwards, after the guest leaves, we sort of hash out the next week's. And I told him last week this time, I said, you know, we've been doing this show since the beginning of the year. This was the first time that the guest picked a movie where I had seen it so many times that I didn't like sit down and watch it the way I normally would for show prep. I put it on.
Were there
like,
even
I had
any
it on
movies?
While I was doing stuff.
I don't even know
if there were any movies in the last show that you didn't. I mean, I feel like there was a couple of times you're like, I got a busy week. Yeah. And I was like, I'll take this one, boss. And you were like, nah, I got to watch some movies. I mean.
Yeah. I mean, Mariah, I rewatched Godfather 2, but I was like, I've seen Desperately Seeking Susan so many times. It is one of my favorite movies. Not one of my favorite 80s movies, not one of my favorite New York. It is one of my favorite movies. It is pure joy. It is so smart and so funny and so sweet. And there's a lot of
lines in this movie that I quote randomly because there's so many funny lines in this movie.
Yes. But the thing that I love kind of most about it, like I loved it before I had ever talked to Susan and before I knew its origins and so forth. But now I really do fixate on what, you know, she didn't write it. But that touch that she brought to it, that idea of, I don't know, I long for this time where you had an independent movie breakthrough and then a studio would give you like a script to, you know, that like you could go make for a few million and kind of see what you can do.
You brought yourself to it.
Yeah. Yeah, instead of just like if Susan made Smithereens now, she'd have to do a fucking Marvel movie next, you know? And it's like they said you have this quality, you know this city, bring your authenticity and your verisimilitude to this. And she did. Like when you look at how she filled out the supporting roles with all of these like sort of downtown artists and actors and weirdos, and filled it up with these NY, you know, these great New York City character actors. You know, I mean, like John Turturro and Richard Edson are in here before they were, you know, Vito and Pino. Victor Argo's in there. You know, the three identical strangers triplets pop up.
The three identical strangers, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's
wild.
Like,
that's how popular they were.
Yeah, from what
Do
I understand,
have
Madonna.
People like that
insisted.
Anymore that are just like random.
They're influencers,
celebrities.
No, you got to put influencers in your movies.
That's
now.
Depressing.
Uh huh. No. She used all like these great New York locations. They shot, you know, the Magic Club. I looked this up.
Is
the
it
Magic
Danceteria
Club scenes?
Or Danceteria?
I think it's Danceteria, like cafeteria.
I thought it was Danceteria, like dance, etc. Now my whole mind has been blown.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Because I don't know now.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to
But
Google
like
this.
That's, you know, that's where Madonna became, you know, a New York celebrity was just like that. She was this incredible hot girl who danced at this nightclub. So to like,
I like that
you know,
she dances to her own song as if it's not her own song in the movie.
That is such a flex. That is such a flex, Mariah. To be like, yeah, you can dance to my song. You know, I love that. I love it. I love it more than anything. The Magic Club scenes were shot at the Audubon Ballroom in Washington Heights, which is where Malcolm X was like assassinated. Movie theater is the former Bleecker Street Cinema, which was like around forever and is unfortunately not either. So it really, you know, I wrote about it a lot in the Fun City book because it does that thing that the great New York movies do of capturing a very specific moment sort of in the city's history. It's this kind of cultural anthropology. So So we talked about Madonna. This is her first real movie, her best performance, I think. Although she, I feel like she's pretty great in a couple of other things. I feel a little, I almost, especially when I was watching that trailer, I almost find myself feeling a little bad for Rosanna Arquette, because this was supposed to be like her vehicle. This was supposed to be her starring role.
She did win a BAFTA, or was nominated for a BAFTA. So at least, you know, she did get some award from it. Definitely is like, it's an interesting year for her, because it's the same year as After Hours, and she's not quite the big breakout from that either. But when you look at the two films together, I definitely feel like it's a moment for her.
It is. It's a moment for her. It's a moment for New York. They pair quite beautifully. In fact, here in a couple weeks when I'm going to LA for my book tour, the New Beverly is showing them back to back.
There's also another film, I think it's 2 years later. Where is it? Yeah, oh, the next year. So, you know, she had Baby It's You in 83. And then after the Desperately Seeking Susan After Hours year, she did a film called Nobody's Fool that's directed by Evelyn Purcell. And it's a great little film that no one has seen. I found the DVD randomly one time at like a thrift store, and I couldn't believe I found it, because it'd been a movie I'd been, you know, it's one of those like seeking this movie forever kind of things, and it's just randomly there for $3. It's a great little movie, and I think she's really interesting. Rosanna Arquette's like late 80s oeuvre is an interesting sort of, you can see why by the 90s she kind of stopped making as many films, and quite frankly she worked with a handful of women as much as she could, because I think she was able to really be a more fully realized performer in those films than a lot of what the male director she worked with wanted from her, which is another side of the unfortunate coin.
You know, Mr. Perry tipped a little bit at the female gaze and how this movie is different because it's made by a woman. You've written quite a lot about the female gaze, and I'm just curious if there are other ways in which you see the touch of a female director at work when you watch this movie.
I think the way the men are is very something I noticed a lot when I did A Year with Women, and it's certainly not every film directed by a woman, but I think women are more likely to show the softer side of men. I think they're less afraid of, because they've obviously, when men are alone with women, often you see the softer side, and a lot of times I think men try to hide that from other men. I think we're getting better about that now. I think obviously society is trying to break down that toxic masculinity and tell men they can cry with each other and it's fine as human. But I think in particular, both Dez and the husband get layers of vulnerability, especially the husband in the scene with Madonna, where he's just really, he himself is really upset that he's lost his wife and where his life is going. And I think in a lesser hands, he would have been just like some sort of harpy, horrible guy just that we would have hated. He would have been a buffoon, or we would have hated him, or, you know, any number of things. And instead, he's, you kind of feel bad. You're like, oh, you know, just the way that Susan does, where she's like, I got to help you. You need help. You know, and I love that she's able to sort of bring those really sensitive bits out, especially in like the scene where Aidan Quinn's just like lounging with his cat, thinking about Roxanna's character, and you're like, or Roxanna's character, Rosanna's character, and that's a really beautiful, sweet, contemplative scene that I don't know that you would see in a film directed by a man necessarily, where it's just contemplation and a little bit of vulnerability.
She's lonely. I don't know if that's the right word for it, but she spends a lot of the movie sort of by herself. You know, doesn't know where she's going to go, or like she's with her one friend, and what are they doing? They're painting their nails.
Sitting alone eating cake, yeah.
Yeah, like I think this is another way that the female gaze shows up, is that women alone can just be normal people just doing whatever the fuck. They don't have to be sort of some sort of man's fantasy about, you know, either a positive, whatever it is, like just something a dude made up, where a woman can't just like exist as a human being on a couch. They have to be doing something sexual, or they have to be deceiving someone, or they have to be mending a fucking sock for a kid that doesn't exist. Like, they're just sort of people. And I think that's one thing that I didn't, I didn't associate with a female gaze for a long time, but we've done a lot of conversations now with smart women talking about smart women directors. And that is another thing that has sort of, I think, emerged from a lot of these conversations is moments that don't, that are very intentionally not anything extra, that are very intentionally just those kinds of moments, are actually an element of female gaze that men rarely let women be as characters.
I also think both this movie and something like Betty Gordon's Variety show that women can get kind of obsessive about things in a way that's not just not in an unhealthy, like, you know, I'm going to boil your bunny kind of way. Right. Just in a maybe I'm going to go a little too deep into learning about this person. And nowadays, I think we mostly do it online and it's a little bit it's still nutty, but it's a little less like I'm not stalking people literally down the street. But I mean, I think that's something a lot of women do, especially when you meet somebody that you think is cool. And then you're like, okay, one, are they as cool as they think they are? That's a part of the obsession. And then two, like, how can I make them my friend? And I think that's something, I think that's something a lot of women can relate to. And I love that this movie shows, you know, you could, if you wanted to, add a queer reading to it, but it's definitely just either way you want to read it, queer or hetero. It's definitely that obsession that women get with other women that is not, is like something a little bit more than friendship, but not necessarily sexual, that I think most women understand. And it's not competitive either. It's really just like, how I want this person to be my friend. She's so cool. Why won't you be my friend?
No, I like that line in the capsule so much, where, you know, about when they meet and only they know what it is to be themselves with each other. It's really kind of lovely. In terms of influences, it's easy to see, you know, the influence of screwball comedy here, of, you know, your Swapped Identity movies, your Prince and the Paupers, etc. In your interview with her, I love this section in your interview with her, she talked about another less obvious inspiration for this. And I hoped you could share that with maybe the listeners who haven't read it.
Celine and Julie Go Boating, is that what you're
there was that, to? But even more than that, the
Alice in Wonderland?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So, okay, that, both of those are in there. So Celine and Julie Go Boating, kooky Pete women going through their lives with excellent fashion. But the Alice in Wonderland, I love that she talks so much about that, because it's kind of both of them going through the rabbit hole, like Perry said, where one of them ends up in suburbia and the other one ends up in a literal magic, like, shop with a rabbit and everything. And she talks about, I don't know now, I can't remember now if it was in the interview in the book or the interview I did for IndieWire, because I talked to her about this twice. But in one of those interviews, she talked about the color grading sort of changing as Roberta goes further and further down the rabbit hole. So that it starts out with like that sunny, suburban sort of washed out look. And then by the end, it's this deep jewel tone, pinks and purples of a heightened Wonderland. Yeah. I think it's really interesting. I think Susan in particular loves magic. I think a lot of her films incorporate aspects of magic, which, as the a nerd in me, some of the original, earliest, most interesting films are Méliès's films, and he was a magician. So I love that she sort of harkens back to the idea that film can be magic, literally or figuratively, depending on how you want to read it.
That's right. And you know what? Just at the end of the day, it's a magical movie.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's FORHERS.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Want to keep your personal number private but still stay connected? With Line 2, you can get a second phone line right on your device with a super simple app and no need for another phone. Whether it's for online shopping, dating, or shielding your main number from spam, Line 2 is an easy way to manage it all. Ready for peace of mind without breaking the bank? Call, text, block, and more for only $9.99. Get started with line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in any app store today. Line 2, your second line simplified.
And I'm glad you picked it, and I'm glad we got to talk about it. Let's take a quick break, and then we will talk about the movie's release and reception. All right, friends, let's talk about the release and reception of Desperately Seeking Susan, which opened in New York City on March 29th, 1985. We're recording this just a couple of days after its 40th anniversary.
Wow.
Alongside the long-forgotten Richard Gere epic King David and the long-forgotten Hal Ashby, Neil Simon collab The Slugger's Wife.
What?
Also playing, yeah, I know. Also playing in New York that weekend, The Purple Rose of Cairo, Witness, Police Academy 2, their first assignment, Porky's Revenge, Lost in America, The Last Dragon, The Sure Thing, The Brother from Another Planet, Stranger Than Paradise, Beverly Hills Cop, still going strong from Christmas of 84, a re-release of Return of the Jedi, The Times of Harvey Milk, The Gods Must Be Crazy, and Friday the 13th, Part 5, A New Beginning, released like a year after Friday the 13th, the final chapter. That's how easy it was to talk Paramount out of cutting off that cash cow. Mike, what were the news headlines on that day?
Friday, March 29th, 1985. New Yorker, God, it's
all right.
That's the only voice you can use. New Yorker Bernard H. Goetz was released on $5,000 bail. Exactly. See, I told you. After pleading not guilty to attempted murder. The point of this segment is to help set the scene and provide some context for when this movie came out. And I have to tell you that we worked really hard to do exactly that in Fun City Cinema. So you should just go listen to that. I know this is the second Fun City plug in this episode. But look, if it's from New York in the 70s and 80s, we fucking worked hard. Those are good shows. You should go listen to them. Anyway, our opinions on Bernard H. Goetz will not be lost on you.
Fuck that guy.
In U.S.-Canada relations, Prime Minister Brian Mulroney agreed that he was a little hesitant about joining President Reagan's Star Wars initiative. So weird to read Canadian politicians seeming very grown-up and reasonable and boring like politicians are supposed to be. I know we don't reference modern times in our news segments, but I'm sure that ain't fucking lost on anybody either. And in another story, and that thankfully has no connection to now, there was a new government report that said Medicare would be solvent until 1998. There was much fear-mongering about all the awful things that were going to happen after 1998, and some people who basically said we should just shut the whole thing down. And then at the bottom of the article is a little tiny quote after a whole lot of madness from a lifelong bureaucrat who pointed out that these were all preliminary findings based on a new program that it was only a few months old and had only been applied in a couple of places, and that they'd worked diligently with whatever they had when 1998 came. Thankfully, that problem got solved and we ain't dealing with those fucking conversations anymore either.
Yay!
Oh my God, the news from the 80s is so tough. I mean, it's really, and especially because, like, we know that none of this is going to turn out good. All of these were bad ideas.
Yep.
They were all obviously bad, and there were people at the time saying they were bad. And it's just layers and layers of people being like, no, this is going to be great. Don't worry about it.
It'll trickle down. It's all going to trickle down.
The fucking Canadians are going to love us, trust me. Jason, what did the critics have to say about Desperately Seeking Susan?
Mike, they liked it. As per usual, let's start with the Times, where Vincent Canby wrote, "It's now apparent that Smithereens was not a fluke. With Desperately Seeking Susan, her second feature, which opens today at Lowe's, Paramount, and other theaters, Miss Seidelman successfully takes the long, potentially dangerous leap from the ranks of the promising independents to mainstream American movie making, her integrity, her talent, and her comic idiosyncrasies intact." Preach, Brother Canby. The Chicago Tribune's Lynn Van Maitre, called it, quote, a highly implausible story, but one that's told with engaging, often witty style, enhanced by the film's offbeat settings and situations, and the charm of its cast. Those desperately seeking reality won't find it here, but there's plenty of humor and spirit, and the film moves along at a quick enough pace that before you know it, you've accepted the whole goofy premise and are more or less caught up in it. In the New York Daily News, Kathleen Carroll wrote, I'd like to point out, Mariah, I went to the trouble. I tried to find some female
critics. Some women.
Critics,
some
actually,
women.
I found good. Some women. I found That's some good. Women. Kathleen Carroll wrote, amnesia has always been a popular Hollywood gimmick, and Desperately Seeking Susan has all the familiar elements of an old-fashioned screwball comedy. But Susan Seidelman, who's very much a director of the 80s, has made it all the more endearing by adding funky humor and Soho-wise flavor that is wonderfully fresh. And laid-back direction works like a charm, for she has come up with a perfect cast of young actors who are going to be heard from in the future. Desperately Seeking Susan loses its verve in spots, but it's hard to resist this merry romp, which actually makes Lower Manhattan look like a lover's paradise. That said,
is Lower Manhattan not a lover's paradise, though? There's a cat cafe and a pickle bookstore down there.
Look, this is one of my theories about living in New York. I realized that the music was different when I was living there and going to the bars there and trying to meet girls and other fun people there and Thompson Square Park and whatever. I know all the restaurants you liked were closed by then. But guess what? There were other great fucking restaurants.
Yes.
And all the restaurants I liked are closed now. But if I go there and walk around, I can find something to fucking eat. Like, I feel like this is one of these things where we have this constant conversation.
Yes.
Like every generation, the music is dead. New York sucks. It's all right. And like,
because it's different from when I was young. Yes.
Right. And none of that is real because I'm watching this movie and I'm like, yo, I was there 20 years later. It looked exactly like that. Half of those fucking people were probably still there. They just had on roller blades instead of roller skates. But you know what? I had a great time. I mean, I don't. And this movie captures those things. You can just walk into a magic show. It's still possible. You can still do it. Like, anyway, nice movie.
Mike, guess who the one asshole is who didn't like it?
He's becoming a feature of this show.
No.
Reliably bad feature.
No. A new one to this show, but a gentleman we've discussed on previous shows. I give you our old friend, Mr. Do the Right Thing is going to make black people riot.
Oh, this asshole.
New York's magazine's resident shithead David Denby.
Ugh.
Quote, Barish and Seidelman have a few fresh ideas, but most of the picture is calculated and obvious. Is this good that I use like a Poindexter voice for David Denby?
It works. It's fair.
All right. And all that familiar teasing of the middle class, which some critics have persuaded themselves is an example of new wave daring, looks like downtown snobbery and feminist sentimentality to me. Desperately Seeking Susan, it turns out, is not a hip new comedy or an expression of an authentic downtown sensibility the way Stranger Than Paradise was. It's a conventional commercial movie overlaid with anti-bourgeois attitudes. Here is a movie widely praised for originality that uses amnesia as its principal plot device. By the end of the 40s, amnesia was already so exhausted as a convention that only TV shows used it. There is some good fun in this picture, but I don't think it should be hailed as a breakthrough or its director compared with Preston Sturges. If Susan Seidelman has to live up to a false reputation, her real talent might never come out.
This end prick, point. And then he shades it as if somehow he's like standing up for her. Yes. Oh, let's give her for a chance for her. Get the fuck out of here. Can someone
what
explain to me what feminist sentimentality
is? I know. Because, why is that a negative? How's that a negative? How is anti-bourgeois negative? Like, these all sound like positives.
If you're a piece of shit like David Denby, that's when both of those things become negatives. All right, how did it do in terms of box office and awards, Mike?
It made money. It made some money. $27 million domestic in 1985, making it 28th for the year, just below Jewel of the Nile and right ahead of Pritzi's Honor and A Passage to India. It would be the biggest commercial success of Seidelman's filmmaking career. Unsurprisingly, Oscar had no. It's like hit the zeitgeist, dude. I mean, this is Madonna's like MTV lands.
Yep.
You know, like they make this. They're filming the movie, and then Madonna becomes cover Rolling Stone. All that shit becomes a superstar, right? We talked about all of this. It's the only way you taught me all of this. Now I don't know why I'm telling it back to you. And then, like, all of those things are happening while she's in a fucking edit bay somewhere watching some idiot try to thread a moviola, you know, like, just being hung over from the night before, right? Like, and they're, like, making this movie while Madonna goes off and becomes a superstar. And by the time the movie lands, they've sort of hit this... They've sort of dovetailed with this moment that she had actually been building for years and had fuck all to do with the movie or anybody else, right? But of course, the only anyway. Okay, unsurprisingly, that's a good episode. People should listen to it. Oscar had no love for Susan, and this was the year of Out of Africa, after all.
Serious.
Though the BAFTA voters were wise enough to give Miss Arquette a prize, even if it was inexplicably for Best Actress in a Supporting Role. What?
She was
also nominated for Best Actress in a Comedy or Musical at that year's Golden Globes, losing to Kathleen Turner for Pritzi's Honor. But perhaps most importantly, in 2023, it was added to the National Film Registry. Huzzah! Shout out to that.
All right, now it's time for a segment we
Thank
call
you,
Double
Joe
It
Biden.
Up. There you go.
I don't know if he had anything to do with it or not.
He probably didn't. He probably didn't, but it's fine. Next year, like, you know, all of the rate we're going, like, all the movies in the National Film Registry next year are going to be, like, Scott Baio movies. Now it's time for a segment we call Double It Up, where we each select one movie that we think would make an ideal double feature with today's focal film. Mariah, you're our guest, which means you go first.
Yeah, so I thought about this, and I had a couple of thoughts. I'm going to say a half thought that for a modern screwball comedy, I would recommend Maggie's Plan. But I was thinking I wanted to go a little bit deeper. It's sort of a romantic comedy with a little bit of drama, or a screwball comedy with a little bit of drama towards the tail end of the original Screwballs. It's Dorothy Arzner's The Bride Wore Red.
Ooh.
It's to star Joan Crawford. It's kind of a movie where a cabaret singer is plucked by an obscure aristocrat into also being an aristocrat because he thinks that where you are in life is a roll of the die. It's not really based on anything. And if you can pretend to be an aristocrat, you are an aristocrat. And then, of course, this causes problems because she falls in love with a simple man played by her then husband, Franchot Tone, while also courting another aristocrat played by Robert Young. It's got a lot of the same tropes of sort of a woman between two worlds. And Joan Crawford's just adorable and amazing in this. And it's got one of my favorite supporting Billy Burke performances. You can't go wrong with Billy Burke. She's always good.
Yes.
But it's just a fun, silly, like, what was that review that said, like, those looking for plausibility, like, won't find it or whatever. Like, it's another movie. This would not happen. This movie would never happen. It's not real. It is high fantasy and without orcs or something. But it's just super funny. And I think to the point of our conversation earlier, there are aspects of Arzner and screenwriter Tess Schlesinger's sort of female gaze, if you will, in it, in that when somewhat spoilers, but a little bit later into the film, some of the older cabaret, she reconnects with one of her cabaret friends and there's just a scene of them talking about like where the girls are and what they're up to. And someone's had a baby and it's just like a little catch up and you don't really need it for the plot, but it's nice for the character and you get to really see women supporting each other and, you know, going through life as an entertainer, as a woman, you're like always like men are pawing at you. And so you have camaraderie with the women. And I think that, that fits with what Perry was saying about the scene where Rosanna and Madonna finally talk to each other. I think you very rarely still get scenes of just girls being friends hanging out. Has nothing to do with plot. It's just to see them as fully realized people. So I love this movie. I wish that they had like the budget for at least a Technicolor sequence at the end, because she is wearing this like gorgeous red dress and there are photos of the red dress. You can see how cool it is, but the whole film was filmed in black and white. So you don't actually get to see the gorgeous red dress, but it's just a really fun film. I don't know if it's on Blu-ray yet, but it's definitely on DVD from the Warner Archive. They may have put it out on Blu-ray in the last 10 years, but you can at least get a pretty nice DVD of it.
Beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. All right. My pick is a little more obvious. It's, in fact, a movie we mentioned earlier, but I love the idea of pairing this one with Variety. You know, is a more serious take, but on some of the same ideas, the idea of, you know, this sort of, not square woman, but, you know, sort of conventional woman who is exposed to the sort of seedy underbelly of New York life and discovers a different version of herself, a new version of herself, a more complicated version of herself. I think Betty Gordon really is a terrific filmmaker who doesn't get her due, as you said. And for an extra bonus, you get a double dose of Will Patton with this double feature.
Yeah.
Mr. Patton doing a somewhat less menacing turn in Variety. And for me, he's just always one of those actors that I'm happy to see whenever he.
Yeah, whenever he shows up, you know, you're in for at least a good scene with him.
Exactly. Exactly. Plus, just ridiculously young Luis Guzman action in Variety. If you enjoy Mr. Guzman's work, you'll want to check Variety as well. Mike, what's
so
your
good.
Pick? Yeah.
I don't know. I've been debating this.
Okay.
Quite a bit because it's not a great movie, but that's sort of the point, actually.
Okay.
Of the recommendation. The only person involved in anything happening here who was desperate for anything was Madonna to be famous. And it didn't matter how, and it didn't matter in what way. And this thing happened, and all these things come together, and it works out great. And now she's got a proverbial blank check. Right.
Yes.
Like, sort of, not exactly, you know, she's not a director, but like she can kind of go, she, you know, can be a pop star in a way that most people, you know, sort of move over to movies in a way that most people couldn't. So my suggestion is going to be her next movie, Shanghai Surprise.
Oh,
and,
really?
I would just like to say, like, this is a movie on paper. Lots of great things here. Lots of very talented people. Uh-huh. Right, you all. If all you've seen is Madonna and Desperately Seeking Susan, but George Harrison did the soundtrack for this movie, and I shit you not when I tell you the movie would be improved by going and getting AI music and putting it in over his soundtrack. That's how bad the music is in this movie. I know you've seen it because I read your review of it, so I know you know what I mean. Like, how. This collection of talented people could come together and make something so bad is just almost impossible to understand and conceive of. And what I found interesting enough to actually pursue this conversation is that a lot of the things about how bad the movie are about how bad Madonna is. And I watched it. And I had never seen it before, and I didn't read anything about it before I watched it. I was just like, oh, that's a weird 80s Madonna movie I've never seen.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, let me watch it and so whatever. It's got. I've never seen any things with her and Sean Penn together, blah, 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 other than, like, the photos of him punching a photographer. And you know what? Actually, that's the least offensive thing he's ever done.
Right.
So I watched the movie, and, like, I don't know that I'm excited about it, but I'm definitely not coming into it knowing that the whole world has already rejected this film 40 years ago. I didn't understand all of that, including you, who I love and respect, you know? Like, anyway, it's just, she's not actually that bad, and she didn't deserve all of the ire of the movie. She's actually... not bad, and it's just that this is the power of picking films. She didn't understand yet, and she may never have understood, actually, what kind of parts she should have played. Susan Seidelman understood what kind of parts she should play.
But those comic parts are her best. What's the one she did with Griffin Dunne? That one's super fun.
This is what I would like to go back and revise my pick now, Mike, in light of yours. I recommend watching Who's That Girl in
conjunction with
Desperately
Seeking Susan. Who's
That Girl is now we're talking.
Fun.
Now that's what I mean. Those are people who understood what to do with her.
Yeah. That is Glengarry Glen Ross director James Foley helping a bringing up baby riff. With Griffin Dunne as like a daytime after hours. Who's That Girl is fun.
It's got my favorite Madonna line. She's like out getting out of prison and she's getting her stuff back. And the only thing she has is this tube of lipstick. And they're like, what? And she's like, you can't get that shade of red no more. And she says, fire engine red. And like the way she says it, I'm like, that like lives rent free in my head. Get that shade of red no more.
I love it.
And like she would be the, perfect. We would talk about that character the way we talk about the Marissa Tomei in right. My Cousin Vinny movie. Or what's the, right? Like, if it wasn't for, right? I mean, I think that that's sort of, and actually, like, watching those first, like, three or four Madonna movies is such an interesting way to see how the directors understood who she should be, the character she should be, more than she did. Yeah. Because, like, also, like, not very long after this is the baseball movie.
Yeah, and she's so
great
funny
in the fucking
too.
Baseball movie. I mean, great. So, like, to put those together with Shanghai Surprise and you're watching it and it's like, she's fine, but the rest of the movie around it is terrible and she can't elevate it. She's not the kind of actress who can elevate something bad and make it good. But if everything around her is clicking and good, she fits in and is fantastic. So, watch Shanghai Surprise.
At one point, she was trying to work with Scorsese to make a film about Texas Guinan, the club owner, and that's one of the great unmade movies in my head because I feel like that would have been,
good.
Yeah. Well, and he knows how to make New York. Like he would have been able to figure out how to use her in a role that wasn't comedic, but also wasn't Evita, for fuck's sake. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like this sort of like, right? I mean, I think that, anyway.
Sure.
Yeah, you're right, dude. Who's That Girl is actually better than mine also.
Yeah.
Go watch it.
There we go. Go watch Who's That Girl. We all come away recommending a critically lambasted broad comedy.
Critics are totally wrong about that film.
They were
that
wrong
film
about Who's
is
That Girl.
Funny.
They got it wrong.
Fresh. Great. Yep. Yes.
Mariah, the book again is Cinema Her Way, Visionary Female Directors in Their Own Words, out now from Rizzoli. Where can people follow you on the social medias?
I am Old Films Flickr pretty much everywhere.
I'm Jason Dash Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. Mike, where can people find you?
I am Fifth Column Films on Instagram and Blue Sky.
And of course, if you like the show and you think other people might like it too, please leave us a rating and a review on your podcaster of choice. If you'd like to join our mailing list and get our weekly show notes, you can do that at buttondown.email/filmfanatic. And by the time this airs, my book, Gandolfini, Jim, Tony, and the Life of a Legend, will be out. Hardback, ebook, audiobook. Pick it up. You'll like it. We promise. And
my
also,
mom likes it. Did I tell you that?
Aww.
You didn't tell me that.
I gave my mom your copy that I got. Yeah, and she likes it. She reads a lot of Hollywood biographies, something I don't recall her doing as a young man, but she's really in it now. And I believe she had just finished like a Tracy and Hepburn thing before she read your Gandolfini book. And she was like, it was much, much better. I don't know whose Hepburn Tracy thing she was reading. I'm not, there's at least 50 of them. So I'm not insulting anyone who might come on the show next. But anyway, she liked your Gandolfini book much better.
I'm glad to hear that. If you're one of those nut jobs who likes to watch videos of people recording a podcast, please find us on YouTube. Hello on our channel, Guide for the Film Fanatic.
Our humblest thanks to our guiding light, Mr. Danny Perry, author of Guide for the Film Fanatic. And shout out to executive producer Blake Howard, or as we like to call him, the Spa King of New Jersey.
Thank you again, Mariah.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening. Next time on Guide for the Film Fanatic, the great Jonathan Rosenbaum joins us to discuss Carl Theodore Dreyer's Odette. See you then.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains May 2nd through the 12th. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
You know that feeling when you're about to score 30% off, but they want your number? Ugh. Give them your Line 2 number instead. It's a second line on your phone, perfect for nabbing promo codes without inviting spam to your party. Sign up for every discount under the sun, then block the junk texts that follow. You get all the perks, but none of the spammy baggage. More codes, less chaos. Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store and get your shopping sidekick today. Because the only thing blowing up your phone should be good deals.